Welcome to Big Blend Radio's art show featuring Victoria Chick, a contemporary figurative artist and early 19th and 20th century print collector. Welcome, everybody. You know it is time for artist Victoria Chick to be back here on Big Blend Radio. And it actually is on the day of the start of National Park Week in 2024. National Park Week goes from April 20th to 28th. 27th is Junior Ranger Day. But we thought, what about the arts in national parks? Because the arts really played a pivotal role of actually creating our national park service, our national park system, all the way, you know, gosh, there's so many travelers, artists that traveled, showcased their paintings, took them on, you know, even by rail to Congress and said, hey, yo, look at this. We've got amazing places in this country. And our national park service is the first in the world. And so, you know, when we look at Africa's national parks and going on safari, you can thank America for those, that actual service, actually creating designated spaces that are protected. So we thought, what about the arts and parks? And Victoria came up with talking about George Catlin. And George Catlin is a traveler. He was a lawyer. He's a painter. He is a writer. His life is absolutely incredible. But a lot of the places that he traveled through are now designated National Park Service sites. So they could be a national park. It could be also a national monument, those kinds of things. So that's why he's so pivotal when we talk about National Park Week. So welcome back, Victoria. How are you?
Oh, thank you, Lisa. I'm just great today. And it was fun reading and studying about George Catlin. He turned out to be such a fascinating person. And I've been aware of him, but I really had not dealt into his life at all until we got together and came up with this story idea. So yeah, he's a really unique person in so many respects.
Yeah, it's really huge. I want people to know is he was born in 1796, passed away in 1872. And, you know, Nancy was putting the article together. Everyone, the article is up on nationalparktraveling.com. The link is in the show notes, whether you're listening on YouTube or Facebook or Spotify, Apple, all those great places. The link is in the show notes so you can read the article and see the paintings we're talking about. There's also a great Wikipedia page about him. But I wanted to talk to Nancy. I'll just bring her in on this conversation. Don't you dig his art? I mean, it's amazing.
I'm amazed that Native American women were even allowed to pose for him. When you think back then, mm-hmm. I just really didn't think that I could understand him being allowed to paint the men, but not the women. So that was kind of like, whoa, look at that. You know,
in regard to what you're saying, when I realized how many people he painted, I started thinking about what his personality must have been like. I mean, he knew no Indian, when he started, he knew no Indian languages. And and he would go, he's going cold, turkey, cold into these tribal areas. And there's so many tribal areas, and not separated really by very much distance necessarily, but he has to make friends with everybody. He has to convince mm-hmm. them that what he's doing is not going to, you know, be harmful to them. And it just amazes to me. I think he must have had a really high regard for himself. He may have been sort of narcissistic even, because he expected the people to like him, and they did, because he was outgoing, he was friendly. His facial expressions must have been something that the Indians took to heart, and they must have trusted him. Mm-hmm. Even if they couldn't speak the same languages. So mm-hmm. that was what struck me about mm-hmm. about him.
I want to back up a little bit when we talk about that, so folks listening understand where we're going, where he started off, because he was born in Wilkes-Barre. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right, but I've driven through that city a number of times. Yeah, in Pennsylvania. And he studied law, and he eventually said, I'm done with that. I'm traveling. I'm doing art. And he became very, well known for being a portraitist, and doing portrait art. And that's what blew my mind. I'm used, he's got paintings of, Indians on the plains doing ball play, all kinds of, out there hunting and, grizzly bears and all kinds of things. Right. But, he was doing a lot of portraits. What do you think it was that got him out and saying, I'm traveling the country, because he really was part of the West, the westward expansion of this country.
Right. Well, for one thing, not very many years after he got his degree as an artist and had started his portrait career, he met with George Clark, who at that time was the territorial governor of Missouri. And when I say Missouri, I'm not talking about the state. I'm talking about what eventually was the whole Missouri, the thing that went way up, up the Mississippi, the Missouri River. So that was territory, and they didn't know very much about it. So George Clark, they were probably talking about Indians as the painting progressed. And one of the things that interested me was that his mother, not Clark's mother, but Catlin's mother, had been captured by Indians when she was a little girl. That would happen during the French and Indian War, which is like the mid 1700s for the most part. And she had a really great experience being captured. She thought it was a hoot. And right. So when she would relay this story to her son, George Catlin, she had no fear of Indians. She thought they were great. And they were very nice to her. She was she was probably about 5 years old when this happened.
Yeah.
So I think that story colored his view initially of meeting the Indians. He was anxious to meet the Indians. And what happened then during this portrait session was that the territorial governor Clark asked him if he would like to go on an expedition up the Mississippi to meet some of these Indians. It was like a diplomatic mission, because essentially they were going into foreign territory. And even though it was part of the United States, people didn't go there very often, except for maybe fur trappers. And so that was probably the only people that the Indians were acquainted with. So anyway, that experience going upriver in a diplomatic mission just to meet the Indians, and he just really enjoyed that so much. And so that when that mission was over, which probably took several weeks, it was about that time. If you think of the map at that time, you get the Mississippi going north and south. At the area where St. Louis is, that the Missouri River comes into the Mississippi at that point. And so because that territory was new, Governor Clark met up with Meriwether Lewis and formed the Lewis and Clark, what we call the Lewis and Clark Expedition. It was actually called the Expedition of Discovery or something, like a Journey of Discovery, because they were looking for they were going to look for the Pacific Ocean. They thought maybe they could get there, and eventually, of course, they did, although not entirely by the Mississippi. But so they went that way, and while they were going doing that, George Catlin hit the bug in his ear to do some more exploration. So he went up the Mississippi again. And he went all the way in quite a ways into Minnesota, probably about a little bit north of where the Twin Cities are right now. And so he met the Indians. They were probably, most of them were a little bit familiar with seeing him before. So he did paintings as he went, and he loved the Indians. I can't say that enough. I can't emphasize that enough. Because he became obsessed with the idea of doing a painting that would represent every single tribe that he came across. And
That's amazing. That's
did you
cool.
I didn't mean to, you wanted to say something. But anyway, on that trip, he did, I think he did 50 different tribes. And you know, you if you think
Wow.
of Indians today, it's so amazing that at that time they were divided, you know, as into small tribes, so that there were that in, even just traversing the river during the length that they went, that they would run into 50 different tribes. And he was a detail man, and he would describe them so accurately. He was interested in them as a representative of their tribe, so he was really careful about not facial patterns, facial characteristics, yes, hair particular hairstyles, yes, and the way they used to paint their faces. He wanted to make sure that each tribe, tribal markings were different from the others. He was very careful as to what he did, if they carried anything like a weapon of some sort, or and their clothing. So that was important from him because they were representatives of a tribe. But he was also very careful to make sure that he wanted people to see them as he did, as individuals. And they each one had their own dignity. So you think you would do that many portraits of any group, that after a while, unless you were a very careful observer, you would start to make things the same. You know, you would start to generalize maybe, but he never did. He took great care to describe each person as that person was, in addition to that person as a representative of a larger group.
That's amazing. I think he really had integrity in his art, and as a documentarian, an artist and a documentarian. And I wanted to go back to him traveling with Meriwether, and you know, being part of the Meriwether Lewis is part of the Lewis and Clark Trails, also part of our National Park Service. So, you know, we have these parks and public lands, but we also have these historic trails and routes that you can follow. Nancy and I've been part of them. And then there is the American Discovery Trail, which is, you know, our friend, the late great Jim Ostick, actually walked it. It's people walk across the country. He did it from Lewis, Delaware, all the way to Point Reyes National Seashore. And so there's these, I mean, and you're crossing through some of these parks and public lands and things, which are amazing. But yeah, I mean, it's just the portraits. Yeah, Nancy, I think you were really fascinated by the women that he, I mean,
well,
because people had to sit for him, right?
Well, I think when you think about different cultures around the world, you know, and having spent time in Africa, there's no way. There's just no way. Like even trying to take photos was taboo. And when we were there, so, you know, you might get the male, but never a woman. And so I'm just thinking of the different cultures and their differences around the world and how he managed to convince them that it was okay. I think they must have looked at him as some kind of magician or something.
That's very possible because I mean there's a the Indian cultures in America have a tradition of art. So it may be that just art in general wasn't unfamiliar to them. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, of course, art in other cultures, they have art too, but it tends to be more geometric or design maybe than trying to depict somebody in a three-dimensional way. But I'm not sure, but when I think of the southwest part of the United States, when that was later on, of course, it was like the late 1800s, so it was probably 75 years later than Caitlin's trip. But the Indians and the Anglo artists that came to meet the Indians in like in New Mexico, northern New Mexico, they had a sort of a good bond almost from the beginning, because they recognized art, and they respected each other. I mean, the white people respected the Indian traditions, and vice versa.
That's amazing, though. Amount of work he did,
Yeah. Oh, gosh, yes. Yes.
He went
I can't
all
imagine what.
I was going to say, he went all over. He went all over, and you think about how travel was at that time. So he's based out of St. Louis for most of it, right? But he went, all over, traveled the rivers. He went to Florida, North Dakota, Montana, Minnesota. He did quite a bit too, which is interesting as well. He did a lot there. But he went, I mean, there's even paintings of, he painted a Creole woman. So he did, I think he followed the rivers, which makes sense back then that you'd follow the rivers.
Right. Well, he was operating before there were trains. So it was either rivers or coaches of some sort that were horse drawn. I think that's how he probably got to the Great Lakes, because he went all the way up there, and then he went to Florida by an overland route. And when he went in the along the Red River and the Arkansas River, he was going into Oklahoma, part of Texas. And he might have gotten to northern New Mexico, so he really got around. There's no doubt, and he did this in a really relatively short period of time. I mean, he one of the things that he wanted to do as he did this, I think the idea grew in his mind that these paintings tell the story, but they had to be together to tell that story. And he never sold a painting, because to sell one was to send, like your child to the outer Siberia. So he wanted them all kept as a collection. And he petitioned Congress, 5 times, I think, to buy the collection of paintings so that they would always be shown together. Well, Congress wasn't interested at that time in history. They were not interested in buying, about 500 or 600 paintings of Indians. So he was always turned down. Well, then he got the idea, since he had to make a living, and he was married, and he wound up, he had 3 kids. He decided he would take them on the road, so to speak, and he would go from town to town with his collection of paintings, rent a hall, put the paintings up, and give lectures. And so he tried this in Cincinnati, and he tried it in New York, and he tried it in Philadelphia, I believe. And that met with limited success. The people wanted to see them, but he didn't have a lot of repeat lectures. So in each town, there was a kind of a finite number of people that were interested. So then he had the idea of going to Europe, because anyway, he was quite an opportunist.
Like every artist does. Everyone has to go to Europe. Like all our musicians have to go to Europe. Country needs to grow up on the arts.
Yeah. But I think his idea was different. He's like, he always thought he didn't need to study anything, in his opinion. He just needed for people to see his work. And I don't know that he was presenting it as he was so great, or as presenting it as they were so great. You guys have got to see these people, because you won't believe it, so he would take, by that time he had about 500 paintings, and he took all these paintings to Europe. And that was a huge expense. And then when he would hang them, and his family went with him, he would hang them sort of like cheek to jowl, and then one on top of the other, and up, kind of like they used to do in the French salons, where you cram as many paintings together. But of course, his were all pretty much the same size, So they did fit really well. But anyway, he would charge people to come in, listen to his lectures. They could look at the paintings, and he had more success there, really, than he did in the United States, because to Europeans, the Indians were this really exotic thing, and they kind of thronged to see him, but just like in the United States, there's just so many people that want to see it, and then they don't want to see it again. So after his initial success there, his lectures were not as well attended, and his money was running out. He moved a lot while he was in Europe. I mean, he started out in Paris, you know, he did London. But as his money started to dwindle, he wound up in cheaper areas to live. So he wound up living in near Belgium in Ostend. And then his wife died. His son, one of his kids died. He came on back, and I mean, I just the guy was trying to do this monumental project, and it was an obsession. Yeah, I mean, he had to be obsessed with getting this done, and getting people to look at it, to understand the Indians. I mean, that seems to be a real.
He's like an advocate, actually, in a way of like, you know, because I think at the beginning there's fear, and we weren't very nice to the Native Americans, our indigenous people of, you know, and then of course, here comes all the wars, here comes all this craziness, right? And I think it just feels like to me, he was kind of like, he did these incredible journeys, and you want to tell people, you know, hey, this is what you, I mean, how are you going to do what I just did, you know, and do it? Yeah, if you want to, but you know, he did something pretty epic, and he deserves his own trail, but there's maps of it because he did South America, he did North America, and then he wrote about it too. So I think he was exhausting himself at all ends to get this out, like you were saying. He was just like, this is it. I don't know how he even had personal relationships, like had time to do it, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, most of this stuff he did between 1830 let's say 1852, when he came back to the United States from Europe, finally. He was in so much debt, he had to sell his entire collection of art. And this, I can't imagine how crushing this must have been to him.
That had to hurt.
And of course, he didn't want to sell them. He didn't want to break up the set. So it's like he wanted all his children to go to the same home. So he wound up selling them all to one guy. And by that time, it had gone from like 500 to, he had 607 paintings that he sold to this guy who was an industrialist in Philadelphia. And what the guy did then was he stored them in a factory. And so nobody could see them. And so I mean, this guy, Congress turns him down. His lectures don't go as well as he had hoped. He has to sell them now. Nobody can see them because they're in a factory. I mean, anybody would be, normal people would be willing to sort of just give up, but not this guy. And so he had, I think he had done shapes of each of these paintings. He had made what they call a cartoon, which is just a line drawing. Most of the time it's done in charcoal. I don't know what he did his in, but he did it on a piece of paper. So he had a record of what the basic composition was of each painting he had ever done. And so he started redoing his collection.
Oh my God.
And so
I know.
So, I mean, it's hard to imagine. I mean, somebody has asked me to do something again. I don't want to do it, you know, but he was driven. And anyway, he wound up doing 400 of the 600 and some paintings that he had originally done. And he called them by a different name, or they became known by another name, as they became known as the cartoon series. Not because they were cartoons, like most of us think of them, but just because of that would be the classical way of developing a drawing that you would eventually use for a painting. But gosh, I mean, I have admiration for him. I've also keep thinking this guy was obsessive compulsive to the nth degree here. But I think we need people who they're obsessive because they get things done. I mean, he certainly did. And there's, of course, then he at some I forget which way which the date it is. Let's see. I can't remember the exact date. It was shortly before he died because
And are you talking about when he went to DC?
well, yeah, but he yes, because the guy was the first director of the Smithsonian Institution. He's called the secretary of the Smithsonian.
Joseph Henry, yeah, that was in 1872.
He called him up and said, "Well, I'd like he invited him to come to Washington D.C. I think he had in the back of his mind that Catlin was a genius, and that he had may I think maybe he had talked to him to the guy that had purchased his paintings. But at any rate, Catlin worked there for in a, they gave him a studio in the Smithsonian to paint in, and he I don't know how long he lived there. And he left it was that year the same year that he died, and then a few years after that, the man who had purchased all his paintings died, and the man's widow gave all of his paintings, Indian paintings and everything, to the Smithsonian, along with all these artifacts that he had collected with him. So it all, I think it's so key. It's kind of cool that it came around to the sort of what he had hoped,
Yeah, what he wanted,
where everything stays together. Now it's in the Smithsonian. The Smithsonian organizes it. The Smithsonian displays it, and it turns out the way he had always wanted it to turn out. And even though Congress didn't at that time really pay for the Smithsonian, they today they finance it. So
And that also shows, like with the Smithsonian, the power of museums and people who are passionate about museums, Victoria, like you, what you're doing in Silver City and your cohorts, creating a fine art museum is a big deal. And I think, with his art, I mean, he, like I say, he is a documentarian, and you can look at the difference. I mean, Nancy, were you looking at that too when you were looking at the paintings? Like the portraits seem to have, they're
It's
like
personal.
very, they're personal, but then at the same time, some of his lithographs, like they're more, they have life for sure, because he's showing what people do. But I think you're right about his details. But the lithographs, you can, there's almost like, I don't know how to explain it, but it's almost, like an Asian influence in his art of flatness, yet it's not flat. I don't know how to explain
No,
that.
not flat.
No,
Not
it's not
flat.
flat. No, I don't know how to explain it, where he, the textures, maybe it's because we're looking at something that isn't, the actual painting, but lithographs are flat compared to an original oil painting that has,
Sure.
texture, but
Right.
it's not flat. He's not flat, but it's just a different style. I've never seen that kind of art like that. It's different to me. Then
Right.
there's just a,
Well,
I wonder.
he had a lot of engravings done too. I don't think he did the engravings, but they used his paintings to do the engravings to copy from. And so he did two sets of those. He was incredibly prolific. And incredibly focused on the topic of Indians.
I wonder
Gosh,
how
let's
long it
see.
took him to do a portrait.
Yeah.
Because
I think he was. I think he was pretty quick. I think he had. He had an understanding. He must have had a really good understanding of color, because he on his journeys. I mean, he would be in a. He might be in one place for a few days before he'd move on. So I mean, I think he learned to lay everything out pretty quickly, and you know, he probably had a fabulous. Eye and memory for detail, so he might be able, you know, as he might even be able to paint while he traveled up the river, or down the river, and fill in the detail stuff after he'd blocked everything out.
Now I'm laughing at Nancy because when she painted on the tour in South Africa with her tour, when she was painting on the road, you had to switch from oil to acrylic. So Nancy. And we had a car, we had hotel rooms. Come on now. Like, think about the difference.
Well, and then we had people, like specific tribal people who you will not paint. And now I'm wondering if the difference would be because he was a man instead of a woman trying to
Well,
do
that
this.
might be. Yeah, that could play into it. Right.
Yeah, because we found like some tribal people were, oh, yay, come on in, stay here, let's do that. But they always expected that you would want to paint the men, not the women. So, and so I just always got this, and there were some tribes that were like, you're not doing that. You're not pointing a camera at us, and you're not sketching and any of that.
Yeah.
So I just look at this, and I'm like, it's so different.
And that they look directly at him. That's the other thing. Their eyes are
so
direct.
Yeah, and I wasn't in the 1800s, you know what I mean? This is like so early on where you would expect
right.
tribal
Well, I
beliefs
think
to
he was.
really staunch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think probably he was politically correct in a way. He was smart because he dealt with the most important person in the tribe first.
Yeah.
And so that probably got him bonus points with the leader of the tribe and the tribe. So I'm not sure how many paintings he would do of it in any one spot. I know that when he went up in the Missouri there's a trading post up there, quite far north.
The Fort Union one, that's in
kind of,
Minnesota, right? There's
pardon?
I was going to say the Fort Union, but that's up in Minnesota.
I'm not familiar with Fort Union. Okay, I know there's some other fort. There's Fort Snelling, and in Minnesota.
But okay, yes.
I keep thinking of Fort Union as being farther north, farther west. But anyway, I know the stuff I read said he only did 18 portraits in that location, and that was because it was a trading post, and Indians would come from way far away because the trading post was there. So there were people coming to that area, and then he happened to be there, and took advantage of that.
Right. Oh yeah, so he couldn't really. That's an yeah, because so he's not at their home where it's like, hey, you know, let's have some coffee first. That didn't happen either.
Yeah.
But yeah, but it's fascinating to me about how he did it with his art because I love his art. I think his art
yeah,
is
me too.
amazing. Because and this is the important thing. I love that we're doing this at the start of National Park Week because, you know, with our tour, our Love Your Parks tour, one thing, you know, people always think, oh, you know, you Yellowstone and everything, and you know, it's not just about the nature, and we love the nature, and he puts both aspects. He shows the landscape that the different tribes were living in, and I think that's really important because they lived with the land. They were stewards of the land. They, you know,
Yes.
they and they still are. You know, so it's just this, I think it's really important because at the same time, you know, here we come in and we disrupt the way of living with the Native American peoples and move them around, put, you know, take their kids, cut their hair off, all this horrible stuff that we did, right? And at the same time, so where's the documents of what they were like before we came in and messed with them and their lives, you know? And I think that's this huge thing that he has documented what America was like before we started messing around. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, us coming in. I mean, the westward expansion, you know, it's that itself is this romantic ideal of this amazing exploration, and exploration often leads to destruction of what the way of life was, right? And it doesn't matter what country we're talking about. Explorers go off, and I always think I'm amazed at explorers that, like Vasco da Gama, and even Sir Francis Drake, who was crazy. He was not a nice person. He just set all the wars up. Him in Spain, like, amaze me about, you know, all these wars because they were just pissy with each other. He was just like nudge, nudge, and then wars, you know. But these are people's lives, right? So in history, it's, oh yeah, well, this and this happened, but you're talking about lives. And so anytime an explorer goes off,
they didn't view it that way.
Right. No, but it's, they come off and here comes, we're claiming this land, we're doing this. And the people that were there, they may have had tribal disputes over boundaries and land, but it was their own stuff. It's like Africa, very similar, you know. But my gosh, man, here we come. Who documented all this? And I think when we go to these parks and these historic sites and these royal roads, these routes like the El Camino de las Tejas National Historic Trail, goes from Mexico all the way up to Louisiana. These trails, you can follow the Lewis and Clark trails, great, but think about when you go in some of the areas on these trails, you'll find swales, like the Natchez Trace Parkway, which is where Meriwether killed himself on the Natchez Trace Parkway, what it is today. That's where he shot himself in his cabin, and you can go visit that. He went nuts over, I think there's this, once you go out there, you can't go back to civilized life. And he was trying to get his documents to Thomas Jefferson. There's this whole history of it, right? But who documented all of this, right? You know, Lewis and Clark documented it in writing. And you've got to think Fremont. Fremont had, he did this whole thing. You know, he went out with Kit Carson, but he couldn't even keep his doc. He, like, his wife wrote his, they say, there's a whole thing about this that, Fremont's wife wrote the journals for Jefferson and Thomas Jefferson. That was the thing. It wasn't Meriwether's wife. It was Fremont. But he painted them and showed them like it's a history for them too, you know?
Sure.
Because everything was storytelling. So there's that history, but it's not written down. So like languages right now are being preserved. We've met people who are working on their languages being preserved and shared so that the younger generation knows their languages. So it's actually the Smithsonian's part of that and Congress so that it's actually documented and, you know, the main library of America kind of thing. And so I think his paintings are so crucial. You know, it's not just fascinating for us all and to understand the landscape, but his paintings are crucial for the Native American peoples to see their family, their ancestors.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah. You hear names. I mean, I can remember when I was in grade school hearing names of certain people and then some of them Indians, and like Shakopee, for instance. There's a town in Minnesota called Shakopee, Minnesota.
Oh, okay.
South of Minneapolis. Cool. So you when you see a picture, you know, it brings it to life. And and even though my hearing about it is separated by about, you know, by 70 years from my seeing the picture of Shakopee, it still brings it back. You know, I can still put the two together. So that's kind of a fun thing, I think, to have happen.
I think it's just amazing to show. I mean, it's just amazing. Go ahead, Nancy. Sorry.
I was going to say his paintings, every single one of them especially the portraits, show a sense of the people being proud, not egotistical, but
Right.
they are proud to have been asked to be a model. I don't even, that's the wrong word, to be, I don't know what
Documented.
the,
No,
yeah.
that sounds bad now. We can't say that.
But
I
I
didn't
don't
mean
know
that.
what you can say anymore. But I just think
Well,
they
I mean,
look
you know, he has,
portrayed,
he's asked them.
portrayed, portrayed
Yeah.
is the word. That's why it's called portraiture. Portrayed.
And you know that it has, it does show a history that it's not like there's a lot of photographs from back then,
Right.
you know. So I just think it's an incredible history that he has, that I hope I that somehow he knows about it. Maybe, you know, when he was physically doing this work, that he had to think, I hope this lives to the future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It, because it makes a difference when you look
Because
at those portraits. Yeah.
He was part of the
Amazing.
change. He was part of that
Yeah.
change. So he knew that the expansion
Well, I
was going
think,
to happen, you know?
Yeah. But he knew, he understood at some level, he understood why this collection of paintings that he had done needed to stick together. They needed to be seen as an entity, not just as single pieces. And because it's a, if you look at the whole thing, I mean, it is really, really impressive.
Yeah. Because
It
if
is.
you divide them up, then you don't get the same feeling as when you look at them all together.
No. The impact
You just don't.
is different.
Yeah. I love stories like this, you know, of someone following their passion, even if you keep getting told no, to keep going. So it's an inspiring story, but the documentation, the art, and showing the importance of art. You know, when we talk about arts and, you know, with what we do with the National Parks Arts Foundation, you know, they have artists in residency, you know, they get to spend a month in a park and really dig in. A lot of them go in and change what they thought they were going to do as their, you know, project when they go in, because they go down rabbit holes of someone or something, you know, something changes, they connect
Well,
and they get to go in the archives.
Yeah, what their idea was of what it was going to be like, it's totally different. I mean, I thought, because I'd read so much about Africa and seen so many photos, that, you know, this is not going to be that hard. And when I got there, I was like, whoa.
Well,
So,
and you make
and
a
it
really good
really,
point on that,
yeah. Yeah.
because he was there painting them in
Yeah.
person. So, Nancy, when you started art and you were painting,
Oh.
like going to a zoo versus seeing an animal in the wild,
Oh,
you can tell who was
exactly.
painting from a photograph that you saw on Pinterest, or going to
Yeah.
the zoo versus going out into the wild.
The
He
wild.
did
It
the
was
real deal
totally different.
versus now we can, like, oh, let me paint Chief Joseph. Well, if you didn't meet him, how are you going to paint him? You know, he does have a couple photos of him. So you're going to paint from a photo that you didn't take. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's different. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying, I mean, and you have, you, I
it's
mean, there's
not,
so many
you don't
artists
get the
paint.
personality.
Yeah.
Yeah,
It's not the
Your
same. Yeah. There's a different
experience is
energy.
different.
There's a
Yeah.
real energy, because that's a live moment that happened.
Yeah.
He captured that live moment in time. And I think when someone is sitting for a portrait, there's a relationship that comes through. I mean, you're sitting there and you're supposed to sit still, and then, come on, you know, there's flies buzzing around and mosquitoes and things. You
Yeah,
know, come on.
but
How do
you
you sit
also
still?
talk. You know, you also talk, and there's certain expressions that certain people will make, like, okay, I want to say the word smirk, but that doesn't sound so nice. But there are, you know, when they hear something that they're like, oh yeah, right, or they think it's funny, there's kind of a little smirk.
Right.
And I think that it's telling about their personality, that you can see if somebody paints a person who's got kind of a little smirk, then it tells you that they're conscious of what people say and do and have opinions, and they react physically.
Well, they didn't have a language. The Native Americans have a language, right? Different language than what he has. But so there's body language, but he wrote a book on the Native American. One tribe had this breathing practice, which I find really, and it was called The Breath of Life, that he wrote. And then it was later retitled as Shut Your Mouth and Save Your Life. Check that out.
Yeah.
I love this. This story got me because I'm really into, like in Mongolia, the Tuvan throat singing and everything, and how that relates to the Aborigines doing didgeridoo. So it's circular breathing, and you're using that's a whole other conversation, and I'll go crazy on a rabbit hole and I will not stop. So I'm stopping now, but this is interesting because a lot of them, that he, through his travels, where he was interested in some, a lot of the different tribes didn't want to breathe through your mouth. Some thought it was a disease, and they were breathing in through your nose. And even some of the moms would, you know, cover their babies' mouths to teach them to breathe through their nose. And apparently they had straighter teeth. I don't know. He just said they had really straight
teeth.
It's kind
of hard when you have the flu.
So I don't know if, like, open mouths and breathing, you know, if you think about it, a rock is sitting there and the wind starts to carve off a rock. So does, you know, having an open mouth carve your teeth? I don't know.
What?
Yeah.
Well, hello.
Well, I was just reading about this. I don't know if it's all, but he did write a book on it. Because so
well,
when he was painting,
can you taste the wind?
Well, when he was painting, they were probably breathing through their nose, which is an interest. He's going to notice that stuff because he's painting them as they're sitting there for their portrait. They're breathing through their nose. So as a Victoria, come on. Wouldn't you think that's interesting to paint someone and they're breathing through their nose?
Well, if because they were trying to be, they were probably had a certain sense of pride in being asked to have their portrait, you know, their portrait. They're the subject of the portrait. So, and they're trying to look dignified. And so they're not smiling. They're not having their photos snapped. They're looking serious. And so their mouths are probably closed, especially for that reason. But it may be just that was their custom also, because he felt that their health was far superior to some other groups of people he'd met, especially English people. but of course, the people he met lived in London too. So, I mean, there could be a lot of factors that contributed or didn't contribute to health, if he was thinking of bigger towns. But yeah, I know what you mean. But it struck him particularly enough to write about it, and he was basing his observations just on empirical evidence. I mean, he had no other facts or figures. He just observed, which is what artists do. And he saw healthy people, and I think there was one person he mentioned who was telling him, Indian, who managed to tell him why they did that, that they felt that it was more helpful. And, you know, what they based it on was observation too. So it certainly worked for them.
Wow. Well, there is a scientific reasoning that you have hairs in your nose for a reason. So,
well, if you don't brush your teeth, you'll get hairs.
If you breathe through your nose.
But his observation was quite early. You know, they didn't come up with any scientific reason until the late 1800s, maybe.
Yeah. So he was ahead of his time there. But maybe the Native
or the Indians were.
Well, they were because they.
They were. They were in a lot of ways.
You know, they didn't like have linoleum floors and such. You know what I'm saying? They lived in the dust and the dirt, and so it makes sense to
Keep your mouth shut.
It just it makes sense. So they were living within their environment the way they needed to live to stay healthy and to be comfortable.
I mean,
So it
that's what I was going
makes
to say.
sense.
Bugs, they had bugs. They had, they're living with nature and the land. I mean, that's, you're right, Nancy. I mean, they're cutting up meat that they were hunting for, the carcasses and disposing that, cleaning skins. I mean, you're right. I mean, the breathing, and then you think about all these diseases that, like typhoid and, COVID was all about the breathing, right? So, but then it's like, oh my gosh, don't sneeze. That's the only thing.
But
But
I think we that was brought over from other countries.
I know, but that's the thing. That's how disease spreads. The explorers go off, here we land. We're going to bring our people over, move you on out, and give you our diseases.
Well,
But
and
we'll
I'm
give you
sure they had
spices.
their
We'll give you
own.
spices and trade. We'll give you
Well,
spices. But no, I mean,
spices are cool.
this is just what humans have done. It's human history. I mean, it's just what it is.
I just think he was far advanced for his time.
I love the fact that he was kind of like the artist Anthony Bourdain in a way, when you look at it in modern times, in a
Oh,
way.
okay.
You know what I mean? Going and being able to be, no, there's something about this. I think in law, he probably just, no, he understood, he bailed on it
Interesting.
and
I
went
think
to the
it's
arts.
interesting.
Yeah, but he obviously, in law, you learn body language. I don't know back then if you did, but he probably, you do need to know who's lying or not or whatever. But I think he had a way to be able to communicate and not be kicked out. And yeah, I think there is pride, like you said, Victoria, that was the perfect word for it, of being painted and have your portrait done. Because I mean, even, in different cultures and places, people, like, now that we have digital photography, right? I know photographers in Africa, they're able to show people, yes, this is you on my camera, and I've actually had that experience with Native Americans here now in this country, where I've had to show them, okay, here's this, I'll delete that, I'll keep that, according to what they want, so they can see. And so it's a little different. I mean, we've really gone ahead, but I think the fact that they could see what he was doing gave them ease of mind, because and he probably had a finished product to show them, like, this is what I want to do of you. And they're like, oh, yeah, that looks pretty cool. And no, they're not going to hang it on the teepee. I mean, he showed their teepees, the ball play, and showed, I mean, he really was a documentarian in an artful,
Well,
skillful, amazing way.
for him to go where he traveled in the years that he traveled, it what has to be totally different than anything else he ever experienced. So it's like once you start doing that kind of travel, it's hard to stop, and you have to document it
Hence,
in some way.
yeah, that's why we have Nancy and Lisa.
We
Try, speaking.
it's hard. No, but it is. It's hard to stop. And even when we go back to the same towns, we always find something new. It's never ending. It's always changing. That's why there's a thing about archiving too. Like, we do all these shows and pull out archives all the time, because, you can't just do a really cool interview and then it airs, it goes out there, and then, forget about it. There's something good to be. It's why the power of museums, the power of books, Oh,
film,
museums are
art, that
so
stays there,
important.
Things, in this digital landscape, things get lost in the shuffle. Even if they're there, you can pull them up, but you have to be reminded to pull them up. I think someone needs to do a movie on him, or a TV. I'd
I
love
think
to
that
watch
would
a
be
TV
awesome.
series, and I almost feel like there should be a route the Park Service should do. But then, a lot of his travels are already on, like, the Lewis and Clark Trail and the Natchez Trace Parkway and things like that. But now I'm like, now I'm kind of obsessed that I'm going to have to go
You're gonna have to
and document
turn in
where
your
he went.
car and get a in a boat.
And it's interesting too, because even like the Red River changed course.
Yeah.
You know, and because there were log jams, there were all these things that happened. But God, man, someone has to do a movie or a Netflix series or something like that on him. I mean, this is one of my most favorite stories that we've done. Like, it's epic.
Yeah, it was mine. You know, when we first talked about it and you said his name, and I knew who you meant, but I wasn't excited about it. But when I started looking at it, I realized there was so much more to this guy than I thought. Mm-hmm. And so it wound up being one of my favorite stories also.
Funny, because, you know, having done the art schooling and all that, he was never brought up. And so I was like, okay, I never heard of this person.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I had heard of him. He was sort of a minor painter at the time that he was working, you know, because most everybody lived on the coast. The important painters, were in Boston, and they weren't traveling on the Mississippi. So, you know, it's good. History allows us to reevaluate, and I hope that when we reevaluate, we stick to facts.
And not change,
because truth is truth, and truth is interesting. Truth gets
guide you if you mess with it.
Exactly. You know what? And it's
a guide.
It is so much easier to live. It's hard, but a truthful life is you can sleep better. You know, you don't have anything to worry about. Like, you just, that is it. It can be hard, but so what?
It's just not all that.
I mean, I know as a kid, I'm not good at lying. I've had to do a couple of really, you know, serious ones of getting out of countries and stuff that you had to get out. You just I need to go. Like big ones, you know, not big ones, but like sometimes life and death is different, right? When it comes to, you know, I'm lying about skipping school, it would bug me because I can't, like, if you want to tell me, don't tell me secrets and tell me not to tell this. I can't stand this stuff because I get messed up.
I always knew.
She knew. Well, everyone. But the thing is, it's true. The truth is important, and especially in history. But at the same time, we think something is the truth about history, and then we'll find a new fact because an archaeologist will dig something up. So that's always a cool thing. It's like science always changes.
That's not the same as lying. You know, it's just what we know at the time. And
but
then
you
they
know.
Dig deeper. Like, look what they just found in Lake Mead. They're finding all these fossils that makes us look at what we've been taught.
And bodies.
It's
and
not
bodies.
Exactly
they're finding
right.
They're finding bodies. But anyway, in closing, I just want to say his art has to be very, very truthful because he was so passionate about the people. And I think they knew it. And I think if he screwed it up, they would have taken him out. That's it, white boy. You're going down.
If they had a woodshed, he would have been out behind it.
Exactly.
I think
he
must have shown them the ultimate respect. And by the same token, they looked at him with, this is a talent.
Yeah, I think so too.
And they might have thought he was kind of mystical.
It's a cultural exchange. It is. Everyone, again, the link to Victoria's article is in the show notes. You can go to nationalparktraveling.com. And of course, always keep up with Victoria at victoriachick.com. Victoria, we can't wait for next month. Oh, we got to get a new story just like this one. Thank you so much. It's always fun.
You've got to feed me some more ideas. I like your ideas. Okay.
Always fun.
Next month. Okay.
And bye-bye. Happy Park Week, everybody that's celebrating Park Week this week. And if you're listening later, we'll celebrate Park Week next year. Thank you for listening to Big Blend Radio. You can view Victoria Chick's artwork at victoriachick.com. Keep up with us at BigBlendRadio.com.